Good afternoon. So, last time, we finished up talking about the completely fair schedule, or that virtual time strategy for having a type of fairness that's sort of about overall compute time you got. And we saw that when we disregarded the issues of trying to limit the advantage you have for just sleeping for a while, waiting for AO or something, that basically what happened is everyone gets their equal share. Why does that happen? Well, you know, if you can't use your full share, you're going to get priority. So everyone gets their equal share, except that they can't use it. If they don't have enough work to do, well, they'll get priority every time they run, but they won't be able to run up to equalizing their virtual time with everyone else. And so that unused time kind of gets divided up among everyone else, who's going to sort of use a little bit of time to get their virtual runtime, up to, you know, equal to be with everyone who isn't limited by how much work they have to do. So we saw that play out in some examples. Then we started talking about programming for multiple threads. So sort of previously we've looked at, things like fork, where we start a new process has independent memory, independent files, and instead we wanted to say we're going to have one process which has the same memory, the same files, but we have two different threads, two different registers, two different stacks, running different things in the same process. And we saw the POSIX API for doing this. So we had this pthread create function, which is kind of like fork, but rather than doing the confusing thing of returning twice, because we're allocating a new stack and all that, we just run a specific function. So you pass a function to start in a thread, and that's the function that runs. We had pthread join, which was kind of like wait PID, and like wait PID, we could return a value from a thread, which ended up being a pointer, and that's not like an integer we got from xSense. And we saw that if we're passing values to threads, well, because we have this shared memory, we have lots more options than we saw with running separate processes. We don't have to do all our passing of information through files and pipes and arguments. Instead, you know, we can use global variables, or we can pass a pointer, and that pointer can point to all sorts of stuff because it's the same memory. We can also use this to return values from threads, that the thread can write to something that another thread can later read from. And so we have this extra convenience. This might be an argument for like why we prefer threads over separate processes. We're going to continue looking at sort of the pthreads API and ways of passing things to threads today. Before we move on to that, questions about things we covered last time? Yes? For the last question on the quiz. So that question has a whole bunch of parts. So do you have a question about a specific part of this? So V, D, and F. B as in, okay. So let's start. So this question here, we have a function foo that creates a thread running the function bar, and it passes the pointer IP to that thread. That thread retrieves that pointer, and then it does some manipulations on local variables and global variables, and then returns null. We also join the thread later on. So question B here is saying that this line here, which is star y equals plus equals star IP, is accessing a value of the stack of the thread that called foo. So foo is running in a stack which is different from bars. So that's the first observation we need to know. And why is that? Well, because when we create a new thread, we create a new stack. So the stack that runs bar is different than the stack that runs foo. And the stack that runs foo is going to be where we store local variables here, including notably x. And we pass a pointer to x in terms of IP, and that IP is duplicated in bar, and that's what's dereferenced here. So that's why the answer is true. We are accessing something that's on the stack that called foo, which is the stack that's running foo. And that must be where x is stored because it's a local variable of foo. Yes?
Can we go over question 2 or 3?
Let me finish going over the remaining parts of this that we're asked about. Okay, so that's B. So questions on B? Yes.
So is the stack called foo, I guess it's foo's stack and not the main stack?
So the fact that it's called foo, I didn't say the main stack because I don't know whether the function that called foo was called for main or was called from another thread.
Okay. So foo gets called on foo's stack.
Yeah, so foo's got called on foo's stack, and that's in some thread, and that's a different thread and a different stack than what calls bar. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's the main stack because I don't know what main does. Don't know how these functions get called. They could get called all in different thread. Foo could get called in a different thread than main. Other questions? Yeah.
You're saying bar accesses the stack of foo.
Am I saying bar accesses the stack of foo? Yes. That is, in fact, what happens. So if you, let me find out. We have a picture. So I believe we had this picture earlier, or something like this. So basically, we have new threads running that are accessing a stack of another thread. And that is a thing we can actually do. That's fine. Because they're all in the same address space, the same memory. Okay. Other questions? Yeah. Okay, so the question is about D. So why are they stored on the same stack? I see I'm doing clever things here. So IP is a different variable in bar than foo, just because they're different. They just happen to have the same name, but that's fine because they're not in the same scope. And they end up being stored on different stacks. Just because of where bar and foo are called, they're called with different stacks. Okay, so let's talk about D. So D is talking about IP and foo and bar. So they're separate variables, and if they're stored on the stack, well, the stack actually means a different thing in foo than in bar. So in foo, they're stored on one stack, in bar, they're gonna be stored on a different stack. And because we have a common address space, we can't have these stacks at the same virtual address. Now, they can't be at the same program address. And we can see that from the fact that, bar was accessing foo's stack. For that to be possible, we need to have a pointer that contains an address and know that it goes to foo's stack and not bar's stack. So they need to have different addresses. From the program's perspective, those are virtual addresses. So they cannot, in fact, have the same virtual address, which means the stack needs to be allocated to a different address when we run bar than the stack that is running foo. And then it was F, right? Okay, so for F, and the F is another example of the same thing, that bar runs at a different stack, so the local variable Y in bar is going to be stored on bar stack, not foo stack. So the stack means different things depending on what function we're in because we have different stacks when they're running. Other questions about question 6? Yeah. Can I explain what it means to have a common address space? That means pointers contain numbers, right? Which are addresses. They all mean the same thing in all the threads. So address 1000 contains the same thing in all the threads. And same is true for any other address. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Why did I say even though they need to have different physical addresses in the question? Because we know they're separate variables, so they could have different values. Right? Setting IP in bar doesn't set it in foo, and vice versa. So if we were thinking about this in terms of like multiple processes, where we could actually have the situation described in this option, then if one process has a variable that it can set, and another process has a variable that it can set independently, well, it must be the case they have different physical addresses because they can't be stored in the same place. Does that answer your question?
So if it's multiple processes, it could have the same virtual address?
This question is multiple processes could have the same virtual address? Yes, and in fact, after like fork, we expect that to happen. Other questions? Yeah. Question for B, the value that's accessed in both stack is the pointer to P. The value that's accessed for B, the value that's accessed on foo's stack is X. It's accessed using the pointer IP in bar. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so then there were questions about, I think, 2 and 3. So for 2, this is asking about minimizing the maximum turnaround time of any one thread. So each thread, we can compute a turnaround time by summing up the amount of time between when it becomes runnable and when it finishes being runnable, when it actually does its work. And we want to minimize the maximum. So to do this, we want to think about, well, what thread is going to have the highest turnaround time. And that's the thread that wants to do the most running. Because all the other threads, you know, most likely are going to contribute less to the turnaround time, even if we delay them for, say, 20 units. So I would assert that, you know, unless something very weird is happening, it's likely that thread C is going to have our highest turnaround time. And that's the thing we want to minimize. Because as long as thread C has a higher turnaround time than A and B, as long as our schedule has done that, the best thing we can do is make thread C's turnaround time lower. Unless we have some reason to believe that thread A and B, despite needing to run a whole lot less, you know, have a higher turnaround time, we should keep running thread C so its turnaround time doesn't get any bigger than it already is. Yes? For question 3? Are you asking about question 3 not or 2? 3, let's get to question 3 later. Questions about question 2. Yes?
You're saying maximum turnaround time on the 1 millionth time unit?
Question, I'm saying maximum turnaround time of the 1 millionth time unit. So within the time period. Other questions? Okay, so then question 3. So question 3 is basically saying we're doing the completely fair scheduler, but we aren't making adjustments for things waking up from sleep. So we're just totaling up virtual time. We're not adjusting virtual time to account for, oh, wait a moment, you were idle for an hour. I probably shouldn't let you run for an hour to make up for that. And under that idea, well, we look at how much could these threads have run, and thread A is doing 2 units of work every 15 time units, so it's sort of running the slowest. So provided we haven't done something silly and not run thread A despite it being runnable for a long time, even if we have, so provided we haven't done something silly and somehow have, you know, other threads B and C not have run for a long time when they were runnable, despite having lots of extra idle CPU time, then thread A will have the lowest virtual time just because it could run the least. And everything should be able to run to complete all their CPU bursts. We have plenty of time to do that. So as a result, thread A will have the lowest virtual time, so that would meet with this scheduling policy. Questions about that? Yes. Wouldn't B have the lowest virtual time? So virtual time, remember, is how much you run in the past. And if we think of how much B ran in the past, well, B ran about a fifth of the time in the past. Versus A ran about 2/15 of the time. Does that answer your question? Yeah, so importantly, like, not only can we not see the future, we don't care about it. as far as what the actual remaining time is. Yes? So question, why are we looking at the portions that it runs? So the virtual runtime, if we wait 1,000 units for A, it's going to be about 1/5 of 1,000, just because that's how long it will have run. And for B, we'll be about 1/5 of 1,000. And for A, we'll be about 2/15 of 1,000, over 1,000 units, because that will be about how long it gets to run. Does that answer your question? Yes. Question, did I say A and B both become just runnable? Yes. And the policy for the completely fair scheduler is we run the thing with the lowest virtual time when we get to make a decision.
Isn't there a virtual time zero?
Question, isn't there a virtual time zero? There is not, because we have been repeating this pattern for a while. So that means we must have accumulated a lot of virtual time from this pattern happening for a long time. So maybe there was a virtual time zero sometime when we were starting up this process, but not, we're well beyond that. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah.
I have also a question one.
Sure.
Yeah, so I guess I'm just thinking about that for thread A and B, it has a shorter time than C, because you said that when it's not able to perform the CPU burst immediately, then you need to queue up the work. So for example, when C ran for 980 time units, B would have to work 980 divided by 5, which is 196 minutes, as soon as it becomes ready.
Okay, so you're thinking, gosh, it must be the case that we didn't run A and B during those 980 time units. I tried to phrase it so that isn't implied, because if they said it's that long into its CPU burst, not that it run continuously for that long, but let's say that was the case. In that case, we have 20 units left for C, and how many units do we have left for B? And how many for A? So A would be 2/15 times 980, I guess 130. Okay, so in that case, yes, you would stay, but that is, I was deliberately not trying to eliminate that, to not suggest that that was what we did.
Okay.
But I'll have to consider that in grading what we do about that.
So yeah.
You can submit a request. I would hope this would be something where you'd write a comment, because you thought there were multiple interpretations. But yes, submit a request, and I'll think about what we want to do about that. I think that it's a weird thing to assume, because it doesn't seem very consistent with the policy that we're supposedly optimizing to have ran C for 980 units without letting A or B interrupt it. Right? That seems like a problem. Or I guess the other problem with it is that we just told you that A and B both became runnable at that time. And under your assumption, A and B would have been runnable for a long time. So I don't think we can give full credit for that reason, right? Because how could they become runnable if they were runnable, 900 units ago? And haven't run since. Yeah.
It says the 980 time unit is not necessarily continuous.
Sorry, the 980 time unit is not what?
Not necessarily continuous.
It's not necessarily continuous, yes. And in fact, we can pretty safely say it's not continuous, because A and B both became runnable. Just became runnable. Can I go over question five? Sure. Okay, so question five. We're saying that rather than doing a multi-level feedback queue scheduler, which we found out would basically prioritize our shortest CPU burst process highest and our lowest CPU burst process, largest CPU burst process lowest, we're asking, what do we do, what would happen if we did something else? And let's think about H turnaround time. So previously, what would happen is that when A needs to run, it would get to run as long as B doesn't. And what's going to happen instead with a lottery scheduler with equal number of tickets per thread, that's sort of our new assumption, is that A gets to run about half the time, and C, which we know is runnable, gets to run about half the time. So that means that if only A and C are runnable, A is going to take about twice as long on average. And that's going to increase its turnaround time. So I think that's enough to say it's probably going to increase the turnaround time, even though we know sometimes B will also be runnable. And if we look at the situation with A, B, and C, we also find out that even though A might accidentally get priority over B, probably on average this still works out worse because A takes about three times as long as if it got priority with two other things competing with it with all equal chances of running. And for B, it's something similar, that B would normally get priority and get to run essentially right away. Instead, it's going to take about twice as long because it's competing with C, or longer than that if it's competing with B, C, and A. And it would increase the number of context switches because, well, now we're context switching every half of a time unit, whereas previously we did that sometimes, but we didn't do that when we were running things that weren't at priority level 4. Yes? So is the reason the turnaround time doubles because of the time quantum? No. So the reason the turnaround time doubles on average, so sometimes the turnaround time will be better for A. Right? Sometimes we will just randomly choose to run A. But on average, we're going to choose to run A about half the time. And that means that A is on average going to take about twice as long to get to run as if it was versus it just getting chosen every time. Answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so that's on quiz. Okay, so you're finished. Yes?
How did you get a 3-unit turnaround time?
How did I get a 3-unit turnaround time for B?
For A?
So you're asking for A, how did I get a 3-unit turnaround time? So previously, if A and C were the only things runnable, A would get priority over C and would take 3 units to finish.
And then are we assuming preemption or not?
Question, are we assuming preemption? Yes, because that is part of the multi-level feedback queue scheduler. Okay, so last time we were looking at examples of passing through threads. And I previously showed you examples where, we put things on a thread stack, we run a bunch of other threads, and then we wait for those threads to finish. And what if you don't want to, run a bunch of other threads, do something else, and then have a thread finish? Well, we can do that. So here I have an example where I allocate some stuff on the heap to track my threads. I pass my information to the threads. And then later on, I take the things I allocated on the heap and go through them to join the threads and collect the results. And I happen, just for my convenience, have decided to put the thread ID in this data structure just so I have a place to put it. I could have put it somewhere else. So this ends up with something where we have our two threads, which have pointers in their local variables to this info array that's on the heap. And that's what we could pass things to and from threads. Okay, so questions? Scenario? Yes?
Why is the
info array in the heap? Because in this code, I allocated it with new. Other questions? And I allocated it with new because I want start some all to finish and still have the threads be running in the background. Yes?
So if you did new and then it finished some all new, did another thread go up to the pointer called info?
the question, if I didn't use new, and I just had a local variable info array, you mean? What would happen? So so you're saying, like, what if I did thread info of 2, right, instead of this? So in that case, the threads would end up accessing something which went out of scope. Right, because I pass a pointer to that array, then I return, that array goes away, the threads are still running. So that would be probably cause some sort of weird crash. Well, hopefully it would cause some sort of weird crash. If you were lucky, maybe it mostly wouldn't, and only when bad things happen. You know, your timing happens differently, it would cause a crash. Yes? So question, you're asking about these assignments here? So I'm just setting up the elements of this struct. So the values is a pointer to an array. I'm passing to the threads. Start and end are some values I'm passing to threads. And result is something I read down here. So I don't set it here. Something the thread's going to set for me. And then this is creating the thread and passing the pointer to an array element to them. And I need to cast it to a void star because that's what pthread create expects. It only handles void pointers. Yes? So question, if I declared info without new, with new, so when I declare it with new, it goes on the heap, right? So if I declared it without new, like the alternate I showed, it would go on the main thread stack, so it would be over here, but the problem is that it would go out of scope, it would be deallocated. Does that answer your question? So in front thread, sorry, this should be like threads one, info, threads one, the first thread and second thread. I will, in our original example, we call them front and back, but now we don't have that name. That answer your question? Other questions? Yeah. What? Can I explain out of scope? So, let's consider this function. What happens if you use that function's return value? Maybe I can write this more clearly. This is %x. So I want to volunteer, what happens if I use that function's return value? So wouldn't it be a problem because x isn't pointing something? Because our pointer to x points to x, but x no longer exists. And that is the problem we would have, except rather than it being with our return value, it would be with the pointer we pass to these other threads. Because the other threads would be executing sometime after we return. Other questions? Okay, so talked about creating threads. So something I'd like to note is that we have threads have some resources that are allocated with them. So we have a stack, we have a thread control block. Threads also, we have to collect return values. So if you saw pthread join, we didn't use it very much, but pthread join has a way of collecting that return value from the thread starting function. And this means that POSIX will keep something around, you know, about a thread until you join it. So if you don't join threads, it's just going to keep that information about the thread around and allocated. So if you create lots of threads, you'll run into some problems with that. And you might say, well, this seems inconvenient because sometimes I just want to start some threads and not care about them. I don't always want to join them. Something is I just want to run something. And there's a mechanism in POSIX called detach for this, where basically you say, I'm not going to join this thread. Please discard it when it's done. I don't care about when it finishes. I don't ever want to wait for it. Just get rid of it. So if you don't do this, you are expected to pthread join the thread, and if you don't pthread join, you'll have a memory leak, basically. And this says, you know, I don't care about it. Free it of its memory when it's done for me. Yeah.
What's the difference in this and just don't care
about it? What's the difference between this and not care about it? That if you don't do something like this, then there's going to be memory allocated to track information about the thread after the thread terminates. Because pthreads is going to assume that you're going to join it later. And it needs to make that work. Yes?
What if the thread finishes
before you join? What if the thread finishes before I join or detach?
Yeah.
That's fine. The pthreads is keeping track of information about it until you do that. Question is this just for performance? I would not call memory leaks just a performance thing because eventually you'll run out of memory, right? If your program just starts lots of threads all the time and you don't detach or join them, you'll have a problem eventually where things just won't work. Yeah? It's kind of like what? It's not like delete, it's saying because the thread could still be running and usually will be when you call pthread attach. You're saying, I don't want to join this. So you're like making sure it gets deleted later. Pthread join also cleans up the data structures for the threads, but it does it, you know, it waits for the thread to finish and then does it. Sorry, if I put a pthread attach. Then, yes. When I put a pthread attach, I'm promising I'm not going to wait for the thread to finish.
If we don't use this function, then it's going to default be set, but not going to wait for the thread.
So if I don't use this function, it's going to assume I'm going to join the thread and wait for it later. And it's going to track information to let me do that. Does that answer your question? So if you question, if what happens if you don't use the join function or this? Is that your question? Yes. So the attach is promising that we don't care about waiting for it. If we don't use detach, it's going to assume that we want to wait for it. If we fail to do that, we are going to waste memory. Does that answer your question? Okay, so I saw you can do this after creating a thread. There's also a way of doing it with that second argument we always pass null into pthread create of making a thread start in this setting. Like, I'm not expecting you to memorize this. This is something you can look at. Yes? Question, if the process ends, does the detached thread also end? Yes. So exiting will still terminate the thread. Yes. Over there.
Yeah, so you're saying that if I don't use pthread or pthread detach, that there's a possible memory leak. Is that the same thing for like wait PID or is there...
Question, does the same thing happen for wait PID? Yes. So if you don't wait for a child process, then the operating system is keeping around data structures tracking that child process, so you could wait for it in the future. Yeah.
The only difference between detach and wait PID is that detach just deallocates after waiting.
So detach does not wait. So you can detach something that is not finished. In fact, you usually will do so. And it records for later that when it finishes, please don't keep track of it anymore. Other questions? Okay, so you can see you can set the setting about whether you want to wait for a thread. There's also some other interesting settings you can set. So one that might answer some questions people might have looking at, oh, we allocate a new stack, is how big is that stack? Well, you can say how big you'd like it to be. So you can, when you make a new thread, you can say, oh, I want a thread with a 32 kilobyte stack. So there's a way of controlling that. As for what value makes sense, well, that's a complicated question, and you know, there's a trade-off, right? If you make the stack, if the stack size is very big, you can't run very many threads. Also, you use extra memory. If it's very small, you can't like write a very recursive function in a thread, or you'll run out of stack space. Yeah.
What goes into the adders?
So this is this is a struct that you can pass a pointer to as the second argument to Pthread create. That there's some utility functions to fill in. You don't actually get to know what the internals of the struct are because it varies between like Linux and other systems. Yes? Can I start a type to thrash and later on I wait? I believe it is undefined behavior. I'm not sure, but probably it's undefined behavior. Okay, but a note on errors. So we've kind of just written pthread create and assume that this works, but it doesn't always work. So just like with fork, we could like run out of resources. And pthread create and pretty much all the other pthreads functions actually do have a way of indicating errors. So pthread create will return a value that is not zero. That tells you what error it is, and our errors are this E again for insufficient resources, E and val for you set attributes that don't make any sense, or E perm for you set attributes that you don't have permissions to set. I'm gonna omit error checking on most of my slides because the slides already have enough text on them, but maybe you don't want to do this when you're writing code with pthreads. The typical sort of pattern would be like this, that you look at the return value, if it's not zero, do something. And that's how most of the functions work. So next we're going to look at, we know about multi-threaded code, and we're going to talk about reasoning about the correctness of multi-threaded code. And we saw an example when I introduced sort of the having a thread print something and we didn't wait for it. And depending on whether we exited fast enough, we had this race that, depending on who won that race, we got different results. And these sorts of issues where we have these races, you know, where one thing can happen faster than the other, and only sometimes, are something which makes threaded programming really inconvenient and really hard to reason about. Because our scheduler can run things in all sorts of different order, and it's kind of, from our perspective, looks random. It's not really random, but it looks random because there's lots of things affecting what runs when. You know, all the other programs, exactly when key presses and network input comes in. Like, we can't really predict it. And we have worse problems with multiple cores where, you know, the cores might run at slightly different speeds. You have different cache misses and so on. So we can have all these things where our outcome depends on these races. And we're going to talk about ways of avoiding this with what I'll call synchronization constructs. And we're going to talk about a whole bunch of them. But first, to motivate the example, I'm going to give sort of a classic, silly because this is not how real ATMs work, of an ATM server which has a withdraw and deposit command. So we're running a bank. We have bank accounts which we can withdraw and deposit from. And we have lots of ways we want to have correct behavior. One form of correct behavior is that we want to make sure the amount of money in our system, you know, is consistent with the withdrawals and deposits. It's not, we don't like lose money or gain money from nowhere. So here's sort of my hypothetical sort of server. I'm going to get a request to like do a deposit or withdrawal. I have my deposit method, which retrieves an account object from memory, adds to it, and saves it. And I'm going to say, let's say we have a multi-threaded version of this. We want to handle lots of requests from lots of different users. So I'm just going to run this server loop, lots of copies of it. So I can use multiple cores, for example. Or so I can handle like updates being slow, the save account operation. Maybe it has to like talk to something on the network, and that would be slow. So I want to do multiple of them in parallel. So our assumption is we're running like a loop here where I just like create a whole bunch of them. You know, the idea is to get more done more efficiently. So we have our simple deposit code, and I'm saying that this code can have problems. And it's not obvious that this code can have problems with the form of losing money. That we can lose money here, because it looks like, oh, I'm getting an account and I'm adding an amount to it. Like, that's always going to add, right? So what's wrong? And from the perspective of this C code here, it looks like just adding something. You know, that's, you know, there's no way this can be interleaved with other things to cause problems. We don't have an obvious something can happen before another thing issue. But here's the scenario, and to think about it, I converted my line of C code into assembly, because, well, the compiler's going to have to do that. And typical assembly for this might be, you know, copy the balance into a register, add to it, copy it back into the struct. That's a thing the compiler might do to compile this, especially if, you know, computing the place of the balance is a little bit complicated. And in that case, what can happen is, well, we can have, even on a single core, we can have our balance set by thread A, and then overwritten by thread B, which has no knowledge of what thread A did. And so now we've lost a deposit. That this amount added in thread A has disappeared. So we lost a write. So we have a winner of this race. And this is a scenario we're going to want to avoid. Yes?
So this is an example of a single core, and we lost the write because it's using the same REX register.
This question, we lost the write because it's using the same REX register. So it doesn't matter that it's the same register, because these context switches are going to save and restore REX. But the problem is that we were temporarily storing the value of balance somewhere else. And thread B wasn't aware of that. It had no way of being aware of that. Does that answer your question? Yeah. So the question, could I store both of them in the same global variable? So we are, because account balance is the same address in both cases. Right?
Well, yeah, but you're adding the REX.
So the problem is the compiler chose to do the addition in a register. And presumably just because accessing account balance in the add instruction was inconvenient. So you might be complaining that, oh gosh, couldn't we fix this problem by having the compiler compile this, you know, add amount, you know, having this be one instruction? And that answer will work on a single core, it will not work on a multi-core. On a multi-core, it turns out that even though that's one instruction, it is not an instruction that is executed in one step. It's executed in multiple steps, and those steps can be interleaved on multiple cores. We'll look at that later. Yeah? How does it matter if it interleaves on multiple cores? So the way the processor executes that one instruction can do this same sort of thing on multiple cores. Can have the same, the processor gets a temporary value on one core and doesn't see what the other core is doing there for. Yes. Question, do I mean that this line here wasn't executed? I don't mean that. What I mean is that this line was executed and this line overwrote the effect of that line by writing a new value to account balance. Question, thread A's value is saved on one stack and thread B is saved on the other? I agree, but thread A has no code that knows anything about any other stacks. Right? There's no code. This is the code the compiler generated. It doesn't do anything to handle the case of thread B running. So the compiler needs to write other instructions if we want something to happen related to that. Yes? Yeah. Yes, and yeah, so this move that thread B does overwrites what thread A does, and remember that they have independent REX values because that's how context switches work, right? We maintain separate values of all their registers. Yeah. So in this example, we have the assumption is that we have the same account. So yes, account balance is the same address in both threads. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I just probably was like, I thought the information by separate, like the separate.
Yeah, so the assumption here is that it's the same account. If this was different accounts, that would solve our problem. But that's not the interesting case. Yeah?
Is balance unset?
Question is balance unset? Well, balance was set because we retrieved it. And it's set, yes. So,
do they also share the value of REX?
Do they also share the value of REX? No, because that's how context switches work. Context switch operation is going to save the old REXs, restore new ones, and vice versa. Yeah. So, the question in this: if we wanted the account to be the same value, could we just set it as a global variable? So this would be, we would have the same situation if account was a global variable. In the original code I showed, it's not, but we like retrieve it based on a number. I should make that consistent. Okay. Okay, so this is this lost write scenario. So we want to reason about how to avoid this, and to think about that, I have a question, especially since we want to think about how this works on multicore. So my question here is, let's start with this sort of simplified example to think about what can happen when we have these sorts of two threads accessing the same thing scenario. So here, I have two threads writing to some shared variable X and some shared variable Y. What is the value of X after these both run? What are the possible values of X? This is the give me question. Yes?
One.
Possible values of X after it runs, after these both finish.
One.
And that's the only possibility because Y is not writing to one, X. So that's an assumption we all have, okay? Okay, how about this one? So here we have a trickier one. Questions: what are the possible values of X? So give me any one possible value of X. Preferably somebody who hasn't gone. Yes. So X is 1. So how did you get 1?
Zero plus one.
Okay. Another value back there.
Three.
How did you get 3? So we have y equals 2, and then 2 plus 1. Okay. Another one? Yeah.
5.
Okay. And how do you get 5?
Store 2 into y, y times 2, y plus
1. So 2 into y, then store 4 into y, and then 4 plus 1. Yeah. Okay. Any others? Okay. So those are the answers I basically get. Okay. So let's do different example. Anyone? One possible? Yes.
One.
Okay. And you got that from
thread A.
So we run thread A last.
Yeah.
Okay. So some other. Yeah. What?
Two.
Okay. And you got that from we run thread B last. Any others? Okay, so I have a crazy, a question that like is gonna seem silly here. Why can't it be 3? Let's say, you know, we write bit 0 of X and then bit 1 of X. And we write them separately. Maybe we could get 3. And maybe we could apply the same reasoning to an earlier example and say we could get 7. That we kind of read an in-between value of y from x. Like, so most of you thought that seemed pretty non-intuitive, right? Getting 3 here. because that's not how we think of values being stored. We don't write values a bit at a time. But we need to have some model where we can actually reason about that. So we're going to have this notion of what we'll call an atomic operation. So this is something which happens all at once or not at all, where we don't have in-between states. And we kind of need this in order to reason about how threads work together, because otherwise we get those things where we store one and two and we can get three, you know, which we don't want. And in most machines, some things you'd expect to be atomic aren't. So for example, on most machines, loading or storing a word, meaning something that's sort of the natural register size, so 64-bit on a 64-bit system, is atomic. So that x equals 3 scenario is not possible because loading and storing values into x happens in a 64-bit chunk, not in a bit at a time. And I said aligned here, if you do things that are not a multiple of the size of your values, this might not be true. Typically, however, your compiler is going to range for like a long to be at an address that's a multiple of the size of a long. So that won't be a consideration. Now, some instructions that aren't loads and stores aren't atomic. So I tell you loads and stores, usually atomic. Other instructions, often not, including single instructions. So like adding a constant to a memory location isn't. Things that cross cache blocks, if you remember caches from a prior course, often are not atomic. And just because people might not believe this, let's look at the single add instruction. Because, you know, the natural proposal was, oh gosh, you know, I had that add there that was done with a temporary value. Let's say I did the add, you know, directly to a global variable with an add instruction. That should mean that I can't have that scenario where I have lost writes, right? Now, if we go back to our original scenario, this lost write, it looked like it only happened because the compiler was silly and used a temporary value, put things in RAX. So here, I have some code where I have an add instruction that's writing directly to a global variable with one instruction. x86 lets me do that. And I just have a loop which does that, and I'm going to run that loop from two different threads. Okay. And I'm going to run it with a million iterations. So what I would expect is I get 2 million, right? I do a million adds of one from one thread, a million adds from another from another thread. They're add instructions, and on a single core, I would in fact always get 2 million. But I ran this on my desktop, which is not a single core. And I ran this actually a lot of times, and here's a histogram of the results. So you can see 2 million does not really appear on this histogram. That's the red line here. And usually you get a million, sometimes I get less than a million. And this is because the actual implementation of the add instruction is not atomic. It's not all done at once, it's done in pieces. And when we have multiple cores, we can observe that. Because one core is doing one piece, another core is doing a different piece, and they can see in-between values. And probably the pieces are that the processor loads the value from memory into a register temporarily, does the add, then stores it back, and those are separate steps. And in fact, can be probably, you know, it's actually more complicated than that, we'll talk later, but that's it. Something to note, so we can't actually rely on instructions that aren't known to be atomic. So you can't just assume, oh gosh, this one instruction, no, that's going to be good enough. Nope, sorry. On multiple cores, that will really get you in trouble. It really will be something where you do it on two processors. You know, it doesn't matter that it's one instruction. It's still going to be multiple steps. Yeah?
On a single core, is it possible that a timer will go off in the middle of an add instruction?
Question, on a single core, is it possible that a timer will go off in an add instruction? So if the timer goes off in the middle of the add instruction, when the processor runs the operating system, it needs to decide, it needs to finish the instruction first, because we have to tell the operating system where to return to. So unless we have a mechanism to return to the middle of an instruction from the exception handler, we can't do that. Does that answer your question? Yeah. What?
Isn't the value on the
stack in this code? Absolutely not. It's all in a global variable called the value or in registers. So here I have no values on the stack. The question is, dot global make on the heap? So, you're asking about here. So dot global makes it so I can refer to update loop from C code in a different file.
Question
is, how is the value on the heap? The value is not on the heap. The value is a global variable. We declare it here. So it's just a global variable in the C code. And it's going to be stored probably in the data segment next to the C code. Does that answer your question? Yes. That means that you can't see it halfway done.
Yeah, but that also means that the thread must be complete, right?
So that also means that if we start an atomic operation, then somehow the atomic operation needs to either complete entirely or get undone entirely. Okay. So to actually reason about things, we're going to say, what's actually atomic? Well, the processor designer is going to tell us. We're going to start by saying, that loads and stores of words, sort of natural size values, are atomic, and see what we can do with that. And we'll find out that just having those loads and stores be atomic is actually not very useful. That it's very hard to actually coordinate multiple threads without some extra help from our processor. So to illustrate that, I'm going to use sort of a quote-unquote real-world example. So let's say we have some roommates, Alice and Bob. We have a common shared fridge. And they want to keep the fridge stocked with milk. So the algorithm is you look in the fridge, and you see if there's milk. There's no milk. So then you go to the store, get some, and return. So Alice and Bob both run this process. So Alice looks in the fridge. There's no milk. She goes out to get some. Meanwhile, Bob comes home. Bob looks in the fridge. There's no milk. He goes out to get some. And behold, we have twice as much milk as we want. So how can we solve this problem? And we're going to think about things that are like our atomic operation. That's like storing something somewhere and reading it. And we can kind of think of that like leaving a note on the fridge, right? That's storing a value and reading it to check for a note. So here's my proposed sort of mechanism. It's rather than like just checking if there's no milk, we'll also check if there's no note. So Alice and Bob will both promise to leave a note before they go buy some milk and then return later, you know, after that, and remove the note when they do so. And this way, we won't have two people buying milk. So this solution, it would work in practice. Unfortunately, computers might follow these steps maybe in a non-logical way that will get us into trouble. So can someone give me an idea? Like, what's the issue, thing that computers will do that would be silly to do in person? Yeah.
Yeah, so after like the thread checks, if no note, another thread might leave a note.
Yeah, so we can have this scenario where Alice, walks up to the fridge. Hi, Bob. Checks there's no milk, there's no note. And then Bob is doing the same thing at the same time, looking at the fridge, no milk. And Alice starts writing her note, and Bob, wanders away, and then comes back and writes a note later on. And lo and behold, we end up getting twice as much milk still. Because, Bob can check that there's no note, and just remember that till later, even though in the real world, this would be kind of silly because Bob was probably waving to Alice as she was writing her notes. But that's not part of the instructions. Don't see if Alice is writing a note. So what can we do to fix this? Yeah. Question, is this similar to sort of pipeline hazards?
Yeah.
It is a related issue, but our solutions aren't going to look like that. Because we don't have things working in lockstep like in a pipeline. Yes?
At the very beginning, we can leave a sort of meta note saying, I'm checking.
Okay, so your proposal is that we leave a meta note. So why not just leave the note at the beginning? So I like, okay. So you have to remove it as soon as what?
Like, yeah, you would have to, you could, you just have to add, like, you can say, if no note, then do whatever, then else remove the note that you put.
Okay, yeah. So you recognize the, so we'll talk about solutions that involve leaving the note early. So this one, you fixed the main problem here, which is that if we just say, let's leave the note before we check for milk, well, that doesn't work because there's a note, so we don't buy milk. So we need to fix that. So your notion is that we leave a note in advance, and then we check for milk, knowing to ignore our own note, right? So here's a version of that. So I'm going to mark who the note's from, and I'm going to check who the note's from. So I'm going to know not to read my own note. So Alice leaves a note, there's no milk, and no note from Bob, buys milk. So what's the problem with this? So this still doesn't work. Even though we're closer, we're much closer. And we certainly saw, and this avoids the problem of buying too much milk. Unfortunately, we have the opposite problem. Yes, back there? Yeah, so we have this problem where Alice leaves a note and Bob leaves a note, and now there's both of them have notes. They say, oh, the other one's checking right now. You know, hi, Alice. Oh, you're checking if there's milk. Okay, I'm not going to bother. And Alice does the same thing. Oh, hi, Bob. Oh, you're checking if there's milk. I'm not going to bother. And everyone else is taking care of it, and so we end up not buying any milk. Yes? Can I explain what? How does this make Bob? So what does the cross mean? The cross means that when Alice checks if there's no note from Bob, that's false, so we don't buy milk. And the same thing is true for Bob. Is that what you're asking about? Yes. So question, could we have the solution be for Alice to leave a note, forbidding Bob to leave any notes? So we could try something like that. So that's the sort of scheme we're gonna get. And there is a working scheme, and I will, and I, there might be a scheme like that which works. I would need to think a lot about it. It turns out that reasoning about how you coordinate things with these atomic loads and stores is really complicated. And I just, the main reason I showed you this is not because we're gonna actually solve this problem, but because I want you to encourage you to use things that are designed for synchronization and not try to solve it yourself, because you will miss things like this that happen all the time. And this is, you know, without that weird, oh, if I add from two different cores, it doesn't actually work issues. So is there a solution? So I'll give you a well-known solution. Your solution might also, there might be a variant of that which works. But this is sort of the classical solution known as Peterson's algorithm. So Alice leaves a note and then waits for Bob's note to go away. And then does it. And Bob leaves a note, and if there's no note from Alice, does his thing. And I say, this is really inelegant because Alice and Bob need to do different things. Yeah, that's kind of how this sort of algorithm works. Not great. And you might also say, Now, how do you prove that this works? That's a lot of work that we're not going to bother doing. You also might say, how do we do this with three people? Because it's not obvious. There's a way of doing that. If you want to look it up, it's called Peterson's algorithm. And we're not going to use it. We're not going to use it because this is really complicated and takes a lot of time. We're going to instead rely on special hardware. I hope I've convinced you that it's really worth processors implementing this special hardware to make this task easier for us. That even though technically we don't need it, it's really nice to have. So we're going to talk about implementing some abstractions that provide something useful. And that abstraction is going to be known as a lock. So I'm going to give some definitions related to that. And then we're going to talk about sort of the abstraction. And next time, we'll talk about how we implement it with some special hardware support. So we have this idea we'll call mutual exclusion, that we want to ensure only one thread does a thing at a time. So in our example here, what we wanted to do is we wanted to ensure that only one thread at a time does this. If there's no malloc, then by malloc. So you want mutual exclusion for that, that one thread does that, and when one thread's doing that, no other thread does that. And we're going to call a piece of code where we want mutual exclusion, where we want only one thread to do it at a time, a critical section. And we're going to have an abstraction for implementing mutual exclusion in critical sections called a lock. And a lock is going to be some object, sort of in the object-oriented sense, that one thread can hold at a time. So a lock is going to have two methods, one which we'll call either acquire or lock, and another which we'll call release or unlock. I'm using both these names because XV6 uses the first set of names and POSIX uses the second. And the typical usage is going to be that we, acquire the lock before using something shared, like in this case, our milk in our refrigerator, and then we unlock when we're done. So with the lock abstraction, our implementation of this, have only one person buy and check for milk at a time, looks like this. That the lock operation will wait till no one else is actually checking for milk, and then the unlock operation will let someone else actually check. Some questions about this lock abstraction? Yeah. Can I explain the difference between critical section and mutual exclusion? So critical section is code that executes with mutual exclusion. Can I answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so we have this lock primitive. I'm sure it started abstractly, so let me show it how POSIX interface for it. So there's something called a mutex, stands for mutual exclusion. That's the main lock we'll use in POSIX. You can create one with pthread init, or you can declare one like with this special initializer constant. And then you can lock and unlock. Some questions about the pthread API here? Yes?
What is the second parameter?
What's the second parameter here? So like with pthread create, we can specify attributes about how the lock works. I will typically pass null, but you can specify, there's different types of locks you can have if you specify different attributes. Other questions? Okay. So XV6 also has locks called spin locks. And this is the interface for them. So there's this init lock function, which typically runs in some code that runs a boot. And then we acquire to get the lock and release to release the lock. Okay. Questions about this? Yes?
What's the difference between
these different types of locks? We'll talk about the typical implementation of these locks next time. That will make that difference clearer. But at this point, it's just the functions are named differently. Okay, other questions? Okay, so we've seen locks. So here I have two threads. Let's say they run simultaneously. What are the possible values of 1 and 2, two global variables, after both run? And so another way of thinking about this is I'm asking, what order can A1, A2, B1, and B2 be executed in? The locks are going to restrict that. Someone give me one possibility. Let's start with the simple case. Just one thing that they could be. Yes?
I think the possibility could be 1 in thread A and 2 in thread B.
So 1 in A and 2 in B. So how did you get that?
Because A acquires block 1.
Okay.
And B is unable to acquire block 1, so it acquires block 2, and then it has
another. Okay, so you're saying A acquires block 1. Okay, so let's talk about the lock operation. The lock operation waits for the lock to be available. So B can't acquire lock 2 in this code until after it acquires lock 1. So if A1 runs, then we need to wait for lock 1 to be released for B to get it. But that will happen, so that's fine. So after A releases the lock, then we can acquire lock 1, but we can't do it before. So maybe that doesn't work. But it's good to clear that up. So important thing to remember about locks. The acquire or lock operation waits for the lock to be available. It doesn't just give up, it waits. So someone want to give me, with that in mind now, yes?
1 in thread A, 2 in thread A.
So 1 in A, 2 in A, and how does that happen?
So if, for whatever reason, thread B executed first and then releases lock, and thread A would overwrite.
So your proposal is we run thread B all the way and then thread A all the way?
Yeah.
And that's indeed possible. So we can get 1 in A, 1 in B, 1 in 2 in A. We can also, by doing the opposite, get 1 in B, 2 in B, by doing A all the way and then B all the way. Yeah. Can it be 1 in A, 1 in B? So 1 and 2 can only have one value. So which one do you think happens last? What? Yeah, but that's what's going to matter, right? Which one executes last? Yeah. And 2 and A. Okay, so how do we do this?
So the way that I think this works is thread A acquires lock 1, does its thing, and then releases it, and then you run all of thread B. And so after that, you'll have the 1 in thread B. But then thread A will reacquire that second lock, and it will put 2 in thread A.
Yeah, so your observation is, gosh, we can run all of this stuff that uses lock 1 right after thread A releases it, and that's fine. So that is a possibility. Can the other way around happen? Can we have, instead of thread B running in the middle of thread A, can we have thread A running in the middle of thread B? So someone, you're shaking your head. Anyone else? Other people? No one volunteering? So what's the problem with that?
B doesn't actually release any.
Yeah, so the problem is that B is holding, I'll use a different color, is holding lock 1 here, right? So A1 cannot run in the middle of that because B has lock 1. So we can't have the opposite. We can't have A1 run before in the middle of B1 and B2. that is not allowed. Is that questions on that? So the prohibited order, so we can't do or A1, A2, B2. This is not allowed because that B is holding lock 1, so A can't proceed. So questions on that? Otherwise, I'll finish up today. We'll talk more about locks next time.